Manhattan's Chelsea Hotel has been home to some of the world's most influential writers, artists, musicians, and actors since it opened in 1884. Among its former guests are Edgar Lee Masters, Dylan Thomas, Andy Warhol, and the Sex Pistols' Sid Vicious, whose girlfriend Nancy Spungen was found dead in their room at the Chelsea in 1978. Although it has been closed for renovation since 2011, the Chelsea and its tales live on in Cheryl Tippin's latest book, which she has called Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased it has brought Cheryl Tippin's back to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. It's nice to be back.
And you were here probably about 7 or 8 years ago to discuss your previous book, February House, which was about a Brooklyn brownstone where Carson McCullers, W.H. Auden, Benjamin Britten, Paul and Jane Bowles, and Gypsy Rose Lee all once lived. Are you interested in the way buildings affect arts and artists and vice versa?
Yes, I became interested researching that book in the idea of creative community, how the environment can help people create work, and how also the three-dimensionality of artists working together. For example, when Auden and Britten were collaborating on the operetta Paul Bunyan, who knew that Gypsy Rose Lee was living in a house with them, and how that affects the work.
Although that was a lot more communal than the Chelsea Hotel.
It was communal. The Chelsea Hotel is literally communal in a sense.
Well, it was started as a communal concept, wasn't it?
Yes, it was started as one of the first cooperatives built by the architect Philip Hubert, who introduced the idea of the cooperative to New York.
And he was influenced by a philosopher, Charles Fournier, who believed in cooperative communities?
Yes, he did. He was a utopian, very eccentric utopian writer of the 19th century. And the architect, Chelsea architect Philip Hubert's father was the architect for Charles Fourier. So a lot of these ideas were brought over to New York when the family emigrated in the wake of the 1848 revolution. They went into exile and they brought their utopian ideas over to the United States.
Was this kind of cooperative housing what Fourier called a phalanx? Phalanx?
Yes.
A radical idea for the U.S. in the 19th century?
Well, it had been experimented with a little earlier in the 1830s at the Brook Farm community other communities actually all over the United States in the 1830s and then died out.
But most of those were farms or places outside of the city. This is on 23rd Street.
Exactly. They were rural communities, and that was a big source of discussion at the time just before the Chelsea was created, times were really bad in New York. It was in the wake of the Tweed debacle, and all the old utopians from Brook Farm were now running the newspapers in New York, so they were publishing articles in New York City saying, what went wrong? We had such wonderful ideals back in the 1830s. How can we bring back that wonderful time in this terrible, decadent era of the Gilded Age. And they thought perhaps Fourier's ideas were good ideas after all, and perhaps the problem was that they had just been out in the country and they should be in the center of commerce where ideas could mix and society could progress forward.
And 23rd Street would have been the center of commerce at that time.
Center because, and theater district. Yeah.
Because Uptown was barely developed. The Chelsea neighborhood in Manhattan has become a center of the New York art world in recent years, but did many artists live there when the hotel was built in 1884?
There was a bit of an arts community of sorts at the time in the area. There were art studios around, sort of scattered around, and there was the beginnings of Tin Pan Alley nearby, and there were a lot of theaters right there at Madison Square. So what he did was Philip Hubert wanted to do was sort of concentrate them in one building, concentrate this energy. And yes, he did. Because of his utopian background, his Fourierist background, he did want to include everybody in his building, not just artists. He did have art studios along the top floor, but also the people who built the building lived there. The people who decorated the building, working people lived there. of all economic classes for the first time in New York City.
Well, more of the artists would have lived in Greenwich Village at that time, wouldn't they?
Well, but there was also the American Academy of Design up on 23rd Street, so that drew some of them up to that
area. On the east side?
Yes.
How many rooms did the Chelsea originally have?
It had about 80 apartments, 80 households, which was the minimum number, according to Fourier, that you should have to have a communal residence that would have enough friction, social friction and energy to get a sort of cultural fire going, which was the point of the building.
And were they typical hotel rooms?
No, it was not a hotel. It was a cooperative. So there was a range of apartments on each floor. There would be beautiful 8 to 10 room wraparound apartments on each end of each floor. And then towards the center, toward the central spiral staircase and the elevators, would be smaller apartments. And the hallways of the building were 8 feet wide deliberately so that people would feel comfortable mingling there, that you could put chairs out there. And the rich people could talk to the less rich people. That was the point for New Yorkers to start talking to each other in a way that didn't happen in the Gilded Age. And it was a very divided time.
And it was also beautifully decorated.
Yes, it was decorated by an interior designer's. He was a silent partner in an interior design company. He had been the right hand man to Boss Tweed. He'd been his bag man. But he became the interior designer, and he became a member of the cooperative. So everyone was included in this building.
And they were paying rent? What was the average monthly rent?
Well, that was another part of it. Another part of the social structure was you wanted people who permanently lived there and also people who were passing through. So they had co-op members who owned shares of the cooperative and lived there permanently. And you also had renters who passed through, not at the transient hotel rate that they do now or did until it closed, but at a slower rate. So the cooperative members paid maybe $100 a month maintenance for 12-room apartments.
And, was that expensive?
Then they had rental apartments, and the income from the rental apartments subsidized it, so it kept the maintenance costs lower. And the artists paid about between $47 and $64 a month for their studios at the top of the building.
When did it become a hotel?
Became a hotel after the cooperative went bankrupt, it happened rather quickly. Co-op members continued to live in the building until the last one died in the 1930s, early 1940s. But the co-op company leased the vacant apartments and chopped them up into hotel rooms beginning in 1905.
So each new owner chopped the place up into smaller and smaller spaces, but they kept the rents at the same price.
You could get a hotel room then, at like a two-room suite for $5 a night in 1905. So
then it became Motel 6.
Yes. But
Cheryl Tippins, Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. William Dean Howells was one of the first cultural icons to stay at the Chelsea. What made him leave Cambridge, Massachusetts for New York? And was this an indication that New York was becoming the new cultural center of the country, replacing Boston?
Oh, yes. It was such a big deal when he moved from the Atlantic in Boston to New York, because he was William Dean Howells was the figurehead for American literature. And he was also a big supporter of realist literature, trying to introduce this idea that the writer should take pieces of the environment around them, the American environment, and use it in their own literature instead of borrowing techniques and images from Europe all the time and England.
Was there something about New York that made it more welcoming to a wide range of artists at this point?
It was such a dynamic city. Also, there was a lot of money pouring through in this Gilded Age. But also, there were the immigrants passing through, the immigration, the Lower East Side. There was such a mix of people, a lot of influx from the provinces as well. So this was where you really felt the potential for America. Was on 23rd Street in New York City.
Well, should I assume that William Dean Howells' novel from 1893, The Coast of Bohemia, was based on his experiences living with all the the different people at the Chelsea?
Yes, it was largely based. It was clearly largely based on the Chelsea at the time. He sublet an apartment there for about 6 weeks while he was reviewing Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy, which was a sort of utopian fantasy. So it was very interesting that he was thinking about this while living in what he probably didn't realize was a utopian-based community.
And then other artists followed, Edgar Lee Masters, Thomas Wolfe, the painter John Sloan. Were they already well-known?
Well-known. John Sloan, for example, was well-known, but he still couldn't sell his paintings, his fantastic New York paintings made at the turn of the 1905, 1910, that era. They were actually stacked up in the in his art studio at the Chelsea, hidden behind a curtain, and he couldn't. Every once in a while, a museum would buy one, but that was the best.
Then came the Armory Show, and let's hope that helped him a little bit.
Well, he lived at the Chelsea after the Armory Show, and it actually didn't. You know, the American artists had just started a little bit of energy going, started selling a few of their paintings, and then there was the Armory Show, which made European art all the more popular, modern art, and sort of slapped the American artists down again for a while.
Weren't some of the writers forced out of their rooms in the 1940s when the hotel went into bankruptcy and was taken over by a syndicate of Hungarian emigres?
Yes. You know, everyone is so, New Yorkers know all about, many New Yorkers know about the Bard family who bought the hotel with the partners in a syndicate in the early 1940s, but they're considered now wonderful guardians of the artists of the Chelsea. But at first, they didn't buy it for that reason, and they didn't even know that it was an artist hotel in particular. And for example, John Sloan, who had no money, who was still very poor, talented as he was, got an eviction letter from David Bard as soon as he took over the hotel, and went into a panic, and he was actually very ill and off in Santa Fe at the time, and had to send a New Yorker friend to go argue his case to David Bard. And it was only gradually over the years that that the artists sort of trained the Bards to respect what they were doing, to understand what they were doing, and to facilitate their work.
Now, when did it start becoming the place that you had to go if you were a certain kind of artist, the Beats, and then later touring British bands went there, and then punk musicians lived there. In fact, anybody who came through New York seemed to want to go to the Chelsea.
Yeah, this is one of the most interesting things about the Chelsea to me, to watch over time how the different cultural layers get laid down. So one generation will attract the next generation, and in each time, with each generation, word about the Chelsea expands. So Thomas Wolfe attracted Dylan Thomas. Dylan Thomas attracted Jack Kerouac. Jack Kerouac attracted Ginsberg, who was friends with all of the Lower East Side underground filmmakers, and some of them came and lived at the Chelsea.
And then later Andy Warhol.
Yes, Andy Warhol. And then Bob Dylan was also friends with these people. So you see them all. You see the resonance within the building of all of these people knowing each other and moving in and out of this one location.
One of the big surprises, Arthur Miller moved into the Chelsea in 1962, the year after his divorce from Marilyn Monroe, and the same year she died. Hadn't he been staying at the Plaza, which is a far cry from the Chelsea? Did he see the Chelsea as a new beginning?
Well, he went to the Chelsea because the photographers had found out that he was staying at the Plaza. And, it was right after he left Marilyn Monroe, so it was a lot of paparazzi, and he wanted to get away from them. And his friend Inga Morath, who he later married, a photographer who was European, suggested he try out the Chelsea because nobody would expect to find Arthur Miller at the Chelsea Hotel. So he went there for privacy.
And then the Warhol people started annoying him.
A lot of people annoyed Arthur Miller at the Chelsea. The pop artists, the group of pop and the happenings, the sort of playful happenings. He thought they were being dismissive, too playful and dismissive, I guess you could say, about the problems, the social problems of the time. And that worried him a lot.
And then, as I said, came the visiting rock bands, the British ones especially on tour, almost felt that they had to stay at the Chelsea. Then there were the punk rockers. I guess that they were going there because those other bands had gone there, and Bob Dylan had lived there. Dee Dee Ramone stayed at the Chelsea in the band's early days. He wrote a novel starring himself called The Chelsea Horror Hotel.
Oh, it's a wonderful novel. Dee Dee Ramone is the funniest writer. I recommend the novel. You really get an idea of what he was like by reading it.
Do you think that the hotel's image was hurt by Sid Vicious killing his girlfriend?
Oh, it was, yes, it was devastating to the hotel. And Stanley Bard, the co-owner, said that the hotel, it would never really fully get over it. But in fact, by the 1980s, when they celebrated their centennial, they started to recover from this bad reputation, and all the artists got together and had a celebration. It was attended by Joseph Papp and Mayor Koch, and they read poetry. It had dances, but performed music, and it was a really beautiful way to begin again.
Is all of that tradition being ended with the renovations? What are the future plans for the Chelsea?
They've had a really bad past 5 or 6 or 7 years as Stanley Bard was ejected and the board of directors sold the building. The building has been gutted and a lot of tenants were evicted. But now there are about 80 or 90 residents left.
They're still living there through the renovations?
They had to live there through the renovation, and it's continuing. The building's, you know, currently gutted, so they'll continue. But there is a new owner has stepped forward, Ed Sheets, who has said that he has great respect for the history, and he has reached an agreement with most of the tenants to move them to another place while he finishes the renovation. And I was thinking about that this morning on the way to the studio, because I was thinking about it. One of the residents there is the poet and artist René Ricard. And in the late 70s, he published an article called I Class Up a Joint for the New York Times. And he talked about how really he is so entertaining that when he goes to a restaurant, people should pay him to be there. And that's how I feel about the Chelsea Hotel residents.
My guest has been Cheryl Tippins. Her book, Inside the Dream Palace, The Life and Times of New York's Legendary Chelsea Hotel. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you very much.